Hello, I'm Julian Rubinstein, and welcome back to the second series of News Roast. Now, we need your help. Can you please, if you enjoy this podcast, subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes, Audioboom, Spotify, Stitcher, whatever you're listening to our podcast on? Because for us to actually get sponsorship for the show, it needs to be high, particularly in the iTunes chart. And so we need you to help us help you give you the best guests possible. We've got some incredible people lined up, but we cannot do it unless you are helping us by rating and reviewing and subscribing to the podcast. So thank you very much and enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to News Roast. I'm Hayden Prowse.
I'm Julian Rubinstein, and you join us on our second away day. News Roast's debut yeah. In the Houses of Parliament. It's a lot.
They let us in
this time.
I saw you walking down the hallway and three MPs dived back into their office.
They're absolutely terrified. Yeah. The thing is, our guest's office is actually surrounded by Tories. You can just smell the opulence. You can smell that sense of entitlement.
It's a fusty smell, isn't it?
Yeah. It is funny though, because they apparently did speak to our guest staff saying, do you really want to let them in? Do you know what they do?
Did they say that to you?
And that guest, who we are absolutely over the moon to have, is MP and co-leader of the Green Party, Caroline Lucas. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. It's great that they let you in, really.
Yeah, well, it's only because you said they could come in. I mean, generally they didn't.
We've been in a few times before, but under sort of different auspices.
Yes.
It's because we came in once and we had a banner that said, because we're worth it.
MP's pay rise. You can thank us for that.
We put it on the bar.
Instrumental. And they were in your pay increase.
And then there was another time where we put a for sale sign on the outside.
Brilliant.
Which they weren't too happy about. But generally, they've actually always been very nice.
I've been in since, actually. I've been to some PMQs. Uh-huh. I had to sit behind the glass barrier in case I
very wise.
Threw some flour.
Yes. Or threw yourself off.
Threw myself
with
off.
With out of desperation.
Yeah, exactly.
But thanks for having us in. Thanks for getting us in.
My pleasure.
For smuggling us
in. I think.
And welcome to News Roast.
Thank you.
Jolene, can you explain what the concept of News Roast
is? So News Roast is three courses of conversation where basically what we do is we invite a guest on who we basically would like to be our friend.
Yes.
And we pretend to be doing some kind of podcasting when really all we're doing is kind of sort of sucking up in a really weird, sort of almost slightly stalkerish way.
Exactly. Well, you want to run to be next Green Prime Minister, don't you?
Obviously. That's definitely...
So you've got to get him.
You heard it first. You heard it first on News Roast. That's ultimately the plan.
It's sort of like a green house of cards.
Yeah.
It'd be pushing people in front of trains to get a carbon neutral
you wouldn't
society.
Because it would be a bit mean. You'd sort of have a talk.
And instead
of state banquets, you just kind of like go to the allotment.
Just put them in a quinoa-induced coma.
Yeah. I have actually, in doing some research, I didn't realise that your father was actually involved in solar energy. Wasn't he?
He was certainly a heating engineer. Yeah. And and I remember sort of right back in the 70s, he was one of the first people to put some solar thermal, I think, on our roof. And at the time, as a sort of 15 or 16-year-old, I was furious because in those days it made a hell of a noise. There was kind of a motor that ran it. And I used to have to be woken up at 5 o'clock in the morning as the sun broke with this blowing motor right outside my bedroom window. So my first initiation into solar power was not a happy one.
That's quite far ahead of the curve, though, for him to be doing that in the 80s.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, I think he was doing it more because he thought there was an economic thing there. And as it happened at that point, there wasn't. So I don't think he put on many more at that point. But ahead of the curve, that's our family.
So is that your... Was that your first dabble into green issues and politics? At what point did you become politicised?
Politicised. It was. I was quite a late developer, I have to confess. I mean, things like the Falklands War and the miners' strike were all kind of staging posts on the way to getting more fired up. But actually, it was a book written by Jonathan Porritt about environment, about nuclear, about women's issues, and it all brought all the different things I've been working on together. And I read that in 1986. That was the real light bulb moment.
This is Seeing Green.
Seeing Green, I was going to ask you about. Yeah, that was the moment that I suddenly saw the light and saw some way of trying to make the connections between the different things I was active in, because I've been active in CND, campaign for nuclear disarmament for some years, and that was one bit of my life. And then I was also active a little bit in the environment movement, also active a little bit in the women's movement, but didn't see any connections between the three, and it was just exhausting. You know, what day is it? Oh yeah, it's that demonstration or that protest or that meeting. And this book brings it all together and also kind of sets out a kind of political set of solutions.
Were you part of the Labour Party prior to that? Did you sort of associate yourself with any other party, or was it immediately you suddenly realised, oh, I have to be green?
No, I mean, I hadn't seen a party political solution to the questions I was asking, because the other parties weren't addressing those issues until I read that book. And then my first party political experience was indeed in the Green Party.
Mm. I was saying to Hayden before we came in that we probably think you're the most badass MP out there.
Yeah. Good.
How many times have you been arrested?
I mean, only three or four.
Only three or four.
That's such
times.
A badass answer, though.
I mean, not many. I just threw it off.
I know everyone puts pictures of Corbs getting arrested by those two police officers, but you've been arrested for
because you, in 2001, you were sort of convicted of breach of the peace by the Fassler nuclear base, which is where the Trident missile. And then, in a true badass style, you just defended yourself in court, didn't you?
No.
Yeah, not very well, actually. I didn't get off that time.
Why did you decide? So you got a criminal record?
Well, actually, they somehow, I'm trying to remember now why they ended up ripping up. I mean, I had to pay a fine, essentially.
Right, okay. Like a caution.
Yeah. But it did go to court, and I did have to, you know.
Well, you are the Human Rights Act, didn't you?
Yes, it was you're kind right. Of in you're your right. Place. Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
So you've done my research.
You have.
Done
you my have. Research. It seems like a hell of a long time ago.
It's because because you're a domestic extremist, we've been paid by the police to come here and research your record.
Okay.
But you were also arrested in 2007. For another Trident nuclear protest, and then also arrested for getting involved with fracking and Quadrilla, which I think seems to have been the stickiest
the
one.
That actually had a week's trial and was very, very serious.
Well,
so serious that I thought to myself, thinking, actually, I'm going to get someone else to defend myself this time. This is not something I can just try and wing and get wrong.
What had you done?
I had sat down along with others outside the entrance to the fracking site in Bolcombe. And,
you sat down.
I know. I admitted I did.
Down.
I sang. That might and have been. That could have been it.
Oh, you mentioned that.
Yeah.
That's so lefty, isn't it? What did you do? I sat down and I sang.
I know.
Violent extremists.
It was clearly.
Yeah. What was your favourite arrest?
It was. What was important was that it was a great way of. What happened after I was arrested was that it did get some headlines, and it was a great way of having much bigger debate about the issues around fracking, and that was very positive. And I was acquitted.
So, Caroline, what have you brought us for your starter today, our starter today?
Well, if I can start with anything, then I would start, I think, with reforming this place that we're sat in right now, this Parliament.
As a Parliament.
Because, as you know, I'm on my own here, which is a bit lonely. But it does give you a perspective on how it works and doesn't work. And so part of my frustration, I guess, with the place is that it is so stuck in another century. Mm. And that becomes not just, you know, quite quaint. You know, people walking around in black tights and offering you snuff. That's quaint. That's not interfering with democracy. It's just slightly strange. Whereas... the fact that we vote in such a long-winded way, so basically six votes here means that when the bell goes, I have to run from this office to the main chamber. And for your listeners, that is quite a long way, because my office, interestingly, is an awfully long way away from the chamber. Mm. You have 8 minutes to get there. So you run across there and then you file through the yes lobby or the no lobby. You don't even think about abstaining because you can't. In fact, the only way you can abstain is if you vote yes and no, which just makes you look very indecisive.
Oh, wow.
That's how MPs abstain, by going through one and then the other.
Or you don't do anything. You just stay in your office. But then all of those websites that very helpfully and rightly...
you're not participating.
Exactly. It makes it look like you just couldn't be asked to go there. Whereas sometimes an abstention can be quite a constructive thing to do. It doesn't mean just, you know, I can't be bothered or I haven't worked it out. So anyway, six votes here take us an hour and a half.
Wow.
Six votes in the European Parliament, or indeed in any other parliament that uses electronic voting, which most parliaments do... takes a minute and a half.
Wow.
Exactly, you press a button. Now, the point of that is not only that it's a hell of a waste of time queuing up to cast your vote, but it also means that the Speaker has the right and indeed the responsibility to decide which amendments to put to the vote. Because if he put every amendment that anyone put to a piece of legislation to the vote, we would be voting till Christmas. And so, interestingly, he has the right to just pick which amendments he feels like putting to the vote. And he doesn't have to make any explanation as to why he chooses those ones. He just randomly does. And so my first experience here, I put down an amendment. I was so excited. It was my very first amendment. And it was about the Strategic Defence Review. And I wanted to suggest that in the Strategic Defence Review, they included Trident nuclear weapons because they were going to leave them out, weirdly. You might have thought the biggest expense within a defence budget might have been part of the review, but they wanted to park nuclear weapons and not cover them in the Strategic Defence Review. Mm. I had an amendment asking that they would cover them, and I was getting more and more excited as we got closer and closer to my amendment, rubbing my hands, you know. And then the Speaker just bounced over it and went to another one, and I was really confused, and I was kind of putting my hand up saying, excuse me, I think you've missed out my amendment. And then someone took me aside and said, no, he's just decided not to put it to the vote. And that's just so weird.
That's mad.
And, you know, if you compare to other parliaments, Scottish Parliament or European Parliament or the US or France, you know, if you've put down an amendment, you get voted on. You might well lose it, but at least you get the right to put it to the vote. But here you don't, because there isn't time, because it takes 20 minutes for everyone to get off their asses and rush over to the lobby and file to the yes lobby or the no lobby, be crossed off on a pen and paper. It's just madness. So that's just one example of how this place is just so stuck in another century.
No idea. Yeah. He has that kind of silent influence over legislation.
Indeed.
That's mad.
Indeed. Well, I think it is. I mean, quite seriously, that some options just simply never get the chance to be aired and voted on, and therefore they are invisible, and therefore political debate is even more constrained than it might otherwise be.
I saw the speech that Mihiri Black gave after her first year in Parliament, talking about how all of her expectations about rampant sexism, misogyny, basic abhorrence for genuine democracy in terms of representing constituents had been completely surpassed by her experience in a year. And I actually found it really deeply depressing because when she was elected, I remember thinking, you know, Hayden and I for a long time, as you know, when we've had events with you, being very passionate about young people becoming so engaged in politics, but everything she said seemed to hark to this almost impossible sort of nub of working in Parliament. And I remember certainly the first time I went into the Great Hall, which, if you haven't seen pictures of it online or whatever, is it 12th century? And it has these beams in the rafters that have been there for,
Commons.
You know, hundreds and hundreds of years, before you get to the actual chamber. Okay. And it's a very daunting place, and you really do feel a weight of history. Do you think that's why reform has been so hard to achieve? Like, what do you put it down to?
I put it down to the fact that the lack of reform suits whoever is in power at that time because it entrenches the power that they have. You know, so the government doesn't want to have loads of amendments because by definition, amendments are usually being put by people who are trying to change legislation. And the sad case is here, really, that people aren't interested in getting the best possible legislation. They're interested in winning, you know, tactical battles between Tories and Labour or whoever it is. And so whoever the government is doesn't want their legislation to be the best possible legislation possible. It just wants to get its bit of legislation through. So it is not, as the government, going to challenge the fact that the Speaker doesn't put very many amendments to the vote. You know, the whole language issue, the way in which most of what happens here is so impenetrable to anybody outside. You know, that all honourable members, right honourable members, right honourable friends. When do you say friend? When do you say member? Who's a part of the Privy Council? What the hell is the Privy Council? Yeah. You know, all of this stuff is deliberately mystifying, I think. And I think it
for
is more
purpose?
Than just quaint, because for those who are in the know, they have some power. And if you're not in the know, you don't have the power.
So navigate the system.
Exactly. And it just goes down to every last bit of how this place works. So there's this lovely phrase called the usual channels. So the decision about key issues, you know, to do with timetabling of Parliament, let's say, often gets decided through the usual channels. And what that means is that the bigger parties have party whips and they all meet together and they sort things out. But it does mean that those members from bigger parties are treated differently than I am, for example. Now, I represent, this time around, 500,000 people who voted Green, 1 million people before that in 2015. It's quite, you know, I'm only one MP, okay, but nonetheless, it feels to me like my
constituency vote went up again.
my own personal constituency, yeah. absolutely. And my right to serve my constituents is equal to anybody else, any other MP's rights to serve their constituents. And yet I'm kept out of so many channels of information because I don't have a whip, because I don't have three MPs. You need three MPs to be a group. Right. Once you're a group, you get the whip. When you get the whip, you get part of all of this stuff. So just simple stuff like when is a statement coming? When is a debate planned? Usually we find out last of all. And
that's
it's
incredible.
And that's just, you know, it would be so easy to let everybody know at the same time just by a simple email list.
It's funny, isn't it? Because
but it's not.
If you told the British public this, I think there's so much like nostalgia around it, and people are so sort of sentimental about this kind of, you know, these quaint British traditions. I don't think they'd like to lose it, the great British public. You know?
Well, I think there'll be a way of keeping your men in stockings and your snuff, which, as I say,
right.
doesn't do
but
you much harm.
But losing the misogyny and the complexity.
Losing the misogyny and losing the just the way in which... some of those things are becoming obstacles to democracy. So yeah. another battle that I fought was around when you put an amendment to a bit of legislation, you might write something like in paragraph 3, little 2, replace and with or. Now, unless you've done a little bit of background work, you have no idea what that means.
Why have you done that? You're like doing a spell check.
No, you're doing that because you're saying that in a particular clause, the conditions you might be applying to something shouldn't be you either apply that one or that one. You imply both. Right. So the difference between an and an or can actually be quite significant in terms of the impact on a piece of legislation. The point I'm trying to make is that if you just put clause 6, little 2, substitute and for or, unless you've done quite a bit of work to follow the bit of legislation to understand what the amendment's trying to do, you don't know in an instant what that means, okay? So I suggested in the European Parliament, when someone puts down an amendment, they have to put down an explanatory statement, 50 words that simply say the purpose of this amendment is to do X in complete
normal
lay
language,
terms.
Yeah.
Exactly. And it's mandatory to do that, actually, in the European Parliament. You have to do it. Here, you don't have to do it. So I was trying to get it that you would have to explain what you're trying to do. And the backlash that I had for that simple proposal was extraordinary. You know, again, the party whips getting in there. And the bottom line was, they want to keep power. They don't want MPs to know what they're voting for. And I promise you, when the bell goes and we're running from here to the chamber, everybody is saying all the time, what are we voting for? Who knows what we're voting on? People are looking at their BlackBerries. People have no idea what they're voting on.
Do you think that there's also sort of that power protects itself and that the institutions of power in this country are vested in very, very few public schools with very, very elitist mentalities, that the language that is taught in these schools, the conventions of speech, the way that one is supposed to interact, that these are literally just passed over into this building and are direct preparation for this building, and that they resent you trying to modernise it, and they resent you trying to, you know, get in the way of, you know, essentially a type of, you know, it's a non-direct form of hereditary peerage.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It really is like, you know, it's just...
sort of a cultural peerage.
Yeah, like entitlement.
Like indicators of how you talk and the way you behave and you're sort of, you're part of the club.
And for a very, you know, in very small doses, you know, I have realised, especially in the last couple of years with, you know, some people came into my life, that there is this, particularly at Oxford, at Cambridge, you know, Eton, Harrow, Rugby, these schools, there is an aggressive determination to keep these things in place. How have you experienced that? Like, what have been your experiences of really kind of butting heads with that power being like?
Well, just a little example. I mean, it wasn't exactly butting heads, but it was having a big debate about it. It was just on the radio a few days ago. I was asked to debate against a Tory MP who was objecting to the proposal, actually from a Lib Dem, that instead of calling each other the Right Honourable Member for Worthing or Bognor or whatever, you just say John Brown or, you know,
Comrade.
Joanna. Yeah, exactly.
Or Caroline Lucas.
Or indeed Caroline Lucas. So you don't always have to remember to refer to someone by the constituency. And also, the point of it is that anyone following the debate knows who you're talking about, which is also quite helpful. So I was supporting the change, the optional change, actually. It wasn't suggesting everyone had to do it, but you should be allowed to do it. Right now, you're not allowed in the chamber to use someone's name. You have to use their... you know, their label. And the Tory MP I was debating with, you know, you would have thought that we were debating the end of Parliament, as you know it. You know, he was saying, this is going to be the end of decorum. It's going to be dreadful. To which you are saying, have you listened to PMQs, Prime Minister's questions, any time recently? If you think that's decorum, you've got a funny... but it's you know, just something as simple as that, something as simple as explaining to people what you're voting on is somehow seen as this extraordinary threat. So perhaps in a funny sort of way, maybe they're... Have they just thought of this? Maybe they're actually feeling quite insecure. I don't know.
I think probably more insecure than they ever have. I think that, you know, if you look at the mood in the country right now, you know, I watched you on Question Time, you know, last week. This will probably come out in a couple of weeks' time, so I guess it would have been a bit longer ago. But, you know, you and a number of, let's say, the more Corbynite MPs, you answer questions directly. You state, you know, your feelings. You're not afraid to use emotive arguments, and you don't talk in, you know, sound bites. Mm. And I think that at the moment we're seeing this sort of falling away of the ability for MPs to hide behind a lot of that. And in a way, I guess the language is what you're hiding behind language. As well, right? Mm. I mean, you're kind of, you wrote a book called, you know, Right Honourable, right? Mm. Is that, sorry.
Honourable Friends,
Honourable Friends, ? And I think, you know, certainly, certainly the work that we did in The Revolution Will Be Televised and the research that we've done, you know, over the last 5 years, whether it be MPs' expenses or, you know, calls that term quite definitively into question. Yes. And it's a very unusual time. And what is your sense of the mood that is I guess taking hold of the country or you know more you know, globally really you know a change in the sense of people's consciousness about these issues and how that's affecting you know people in here?
I mean, I think what is worrying is that the contempt with which politicians are held is getting deeper and deeper. And although on the one hand one can kind of understand why, on the other hand, I think it does matter. I mean, you know, however much we don't like the political system, we need some kind of political system. And actually, given the kind of threats that we face now, whether that's the climate threat or Brexit or whatever, we need a state in which one can have confidence and a state that has legitimacy. And I think what we're seeing right now is that falling away of any kind of legitimacy in the public's eyes. And you see it with the disarray that the Conservative Party is in right now. Both sides of the Brexit debate, I think, are just so angry still for various different reasons that we can explore. But, you know, that sense that the country's adrift, that people don't know who to trust, there's the whole kind of context of fake news, there's austerity that is still being driven forward, a climate crisis that no one's even talking about, the general election campaign not mentioned once, hardly.
Yeah.
I just think, I don't quite have the words to describe it, but it just worries me that it just feels as if we've lost our moorings in quite a real way.
And what do we do when we lose our moorings? We cling to our past.
Yeah.
We cling to our traditions. We cling to our quaint imperial past.
Yes.
It's funny, you're talking about this EU place. It sounds very progressive and forward-thinking. You know, you just push buttons. We should be part of that.
That'd be a good idea. Yeah.
But it is interesting, isn't it? Because even though, I mean, something I find probably the most, something that really struck me the first time I ever went into the chamber is that the two leaders stand two swords' lengths apart from each other. And it means that collaboration definitively is exercised from the chamber because it is by its very nature, literally physically built into the chamber. It's opposition.
Do you think that's got anything to do with why we have such a problem with coalitions? I mean, half of Europe is in a coalition and it's working very well for them. Look at Germany. And why are we so anti-coalitions?
Yeah, we think it's weakness, don't we?
We do. And even, in the last election, I was so disappointed. Especially the Lib Dems, you know, I've been an outspoken supporter of Nick Clegg, particularly.
Apart from when he tried to give him antidepressants.
Apart from when I for the plagued him for 3 years.
The police
national
told
TV
him
show.
They didn't want him
no,
to
no,
be
No, I think I think Nick and the Lib Dems got a rough time from their electorate. I did. And I think, they tried to... You talk about reform. They tried to put proportional representation or an alternative voting system through when they were here. And they sacrificed certain things to get that through, such as tuition fees. It was perhaps a bad play. But had they got a form of proportional representation through, it would have changed this country forever and it would have been brilliant. And then after the last election, they categorically came out, having been in coalition with the Tories for 5 years, and said, no, no, we wouldn't go into coalition with Corbyn. And I just thought, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
Why does the left and the centre-left in this country have such a problem with grand coalitions?
It's because Tim had a conversation with God.
Yeah.
and he thought, listen, I'm not sure God...
God told him.
Yeah. Corbyn, he's probably quite godless, isn't he? In his allotment on his bicycle, and that was it.
Who's this week's sponsor, Julian?
This week's sponsor, Haid, is Cornerstone.
Ah, and what do they do?
Well, Cornerstone are a smooth and comfortable shave delivered to your door. And Newsroast listeners can get £10 off their first order if they go to cornerstone.co.uk/roast or enter the promo code ROAST10 at checkout.
Mm. And what will happen then is Cornerstone will deliver a customised box to match your personal shaving routine and your schedule.
Over 100,000 men have joined Cornerstone and are now getting a smoother shave than ever before.
And if you enter ROAST10 or go to cornerstone/roast, you can even get a free engraved razor handle with your first order.
No way. Listen, it's a simple combination of great products, free delivery and fair prices that has made Cornerstone, no joke, the fastest growing shaving company in UK.
Products include, as you'd expect, razors, shave gels, creams for that post-shave feel, balms and even face scrubs.
You can customise each box with other shaving products to suit your needs, so you can try out their full range of balms and creams. Maybe when you're feeling a bit of a, you know, like a bit down on a Sunday, you're not, you know, you've got to have a shave for Monday work. This will make you feel all nice and roasty.
Mmm.
Back to the podcast. We need to move on to our delicious main course. Because, you know, we unfortunately have limited time because, Caroline, you're a very busy woman.
Very busy.
You've got to be doing stuff, you know, got to be changing the world. So, Caroline, what have you brought us for our main course?
I'm slightly worried it might give you indigestion because it's quite big and I was about to say meaty, but it's a vegetarian. It's not. Yeah, anyway, it's Brexit, but in particular the aspect of Brexit around freedom of movement. Because I think one of the things I've found really disheartening in all of the Brexit debates is the way in which there are so few people who will stand up and say freedom of movement is a good thing, and that we should be saying this is something that is precious, that is worth preserving. It's not worth trading away. And just seeing, to be honest, some parts of the Labour Party as well kind of engaging in some quite tortuous gymnastics, because you kind of feel their heart's not in it, but they're trying to work out a position that can keep them all together, and it's really difficult. But to me, I just want to hear more people saying that the right to work and to study and to travel and to live and to love in 27 other member states is fucking brilliant.
Yeah,
and we should
absolutely
be doing it.
I couldn't agree more.
And you know, I benefited from it. I want my kids to benefit from it. I want their kids to. It just seems like it's a precious and beautiful thing, and we're just making it sound like it's traded.
We did a podcast the other day with Ken Loach, and he was kind of, I think, giving the sort of, you know, the sort of hard left argument against free movement. And his point was that, you know, why should we allow our working class community in this country to be sort of undercut by working class communities from other countries who come here to, you know, take jobs for much less pay, et cetera, et cetera.
But the solution to that...
I do get that. I do feel that argument.
But I mean, I to the extent that that is happening, it's a very bad thing, but it's not... Don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Enforce minimum wage rules.
Right.
It doesn't have to be like that. You know, there are rules about not advertising in the EU countries and not in Britain. So that is clearly a wrong thing to do because that isn't a level playing field. But if you've got someone who, a company that is offering, you know, below the minimum wage, then take them to court, sue them. But the company is what's wrong there, not the principle of being able to move.
Well, I was thinking in relation to that, because Ken was saying, you know, Ken Loach has all these misgivings with the EU, as does Jeremy Corbyn.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I've been very frustrated with Jeremy Corbyn's position on the EU. And I feel like there is a sense in which those guys are kind of conflating the free movement thing with the movement of capital and you know, whatever else it is, what the services, capital's reading here, capital, services, labour and goods. So they conflate all of those things, but it doesn't mean you necessarily... I mean, you can keep your free movement and have some trade restrictions, for instance.
Of course you can.
I don't understand why people on the left, like Corbyn can't understand that you can legislate, just because there are aspects of the EU which are, I guess, neoliberal, doesn't mean you can't legislate in this country to have really strong socialist principles in this country to protect workers' rights. And then, it, you know, the EU can be as neoliberal as it likes. There are plenty of very socialist countries in the EU, and there are plenty of very neoliberal countries in the EU. You define your own legislation nationally, right?
Yeah.
I don't
get
why he doesn't get that.
And also, given that capital is moving between different countries and multinational corporations have the power to be moving at that European and indeed global level, then if you don't have some regulations at that level too, then they really are going to shaft you. So it seems to me that I have sympathy with people that say that to some extent, you know, yes, the EU can be seen as a kind of a corporate person's club. But at the same time, it also has the potential, and it's used it quite well when it comes to things like tax havens and tax dodging and so forth, to put in place more rigorous legislation to try to contain all of that. The idea that Britain just floating off on its own is going to be able to control international capital better than being part of a group of others who are working together just seems to me to
be... But it's not even... I don't even think that's, you know, I think... Most people who have a real grasp of the nature of how Tories' donorship, you know, works, and the nature of the companies, and you know, particularly in the financial sector, you only need to look at what you know is in the right-hand corner of pretty much almost all tax havens, and it just happens to be the British flag, to know that actually, you know, what we're really looking at is a completely deregulated state. And, you know, the terrifying reality of, you know, the cutting of the red tape, which, you know, so many people, I think, now are really waking up to post the, you know, horrific tragedy of Grenfell Tower, you know, is that, you know, lack of regulation, driving us down to the bottom, a 0% rate for corporation tax, making this an absolute corporate haven, is the type of Brexit that we're looking at from the Tories. However, from a from a sort of left wing perspective, and you know, we were talking about this on the last podcast, and I know you've spent a lot of time, Caroline, with Yanis Varoufakis. You know, we're all aware about, you know, the sort of bizarre nature of people like the ECB. When you talk about freedom of movement, how do you think practically you could divorce it from the, you know, realities of capital? How could you have and maintain a sort of sense of European identity, which I think if you speak to most young people now, they've all loved getting cheap easy jet flights for quick holidays, they've all loved going away and being able to move around the country. But I suppose the contrarian point of view would say, well, this is a very middle class concern, that a lot of people actually never have that reality. How do you counter that? How would you counter that?
No, I mean, I really do accept that, the sense that, you know, talking about the ability to go and travel to 27 other member states is a very privileged position to be in, to have that choice. But I think the answer to that is to extend the choice, to broaden the choice, to work out how you enable more young people to be able to take advantage of that, rather than saying the solution is to stop it for everybody. And, you know, I think the media has such a role to play in terms of having colluded with the poisoning of people's minds over Europe, because for so many governments now of all colours, you know, the EU has always been the simple whipping boy, the scapegoat. Whenever anything goes wrong, the EU has been blamed. And that's gone on for years and years and years. And so people have got this idea of it as this kind of, you know, faceless, bureaucratic, monolithic sledgehammer that comes down and tells you what you can and can't do. And it's, you know, it needs reform. Don't get me wrong, it needs reform. But it's not that. We do have UK parliamentarians there co-making laws. It is slowly becoming more transparent. You often do get more rights to access documents there than you do even in our own government here. So I think part of the answer is to say reform stuff in the UK so that more people are able to make use of the rights of freedom of movement, but also certainly yes, also reform the EU. And during the referendum campaign, I was part of a group called Another Europe Is Possible, and they were doing a fantastic job in a sense, because they were absolutely of the left, but countering exactly the kind of position you were describing from Ken and so forth by saying yes, that the EU needs to be more transparent and accountable and democratic, but within it also is our best hope of protecting all of the citizens of the EU from the rabid, you know, freedoms of major capital and multinationals and so on.
Can I make a slightly oblique reference that is going to make me sound quite
another
smart?
Oblique reference.
As long as you explain it.
Are you going to make yourself sound quite smart?
Really I'm going to reference a book that I'm reading.
This is the bit in the podcast where Hayden sounds like a posh snob who's reading really oblique books.
No, there's a really good book by Peter Frankopan called Silk Roads, and he describes the Black Death in it, okay, in the early 17th century. And what he says, and I never thought about it like this, is it wiped out, in some places, two-thirds of the population of Western Europe. And that was awful. But the upshot of that, 50 years later, was you had a society that was unrecognisably fairer. You had a smaller population.
It's a high price to pay.
I'm not talking about Black Death.
Are you saying you want to wipe out 50% of this country?
I'm talking about releasing a small amount of bubonic plague. No, what I'm saying is that...
Hayden Prowse is up for Syrian-style biological warfare.
Look, it would make things
fairer.
In Tory
constituencies.
Once you had a smaller workforce, workers got paid more, OK? Once workers were paid more, they could afford more. They became, I guess, more middle class. Rents went down because people could stop charging obscene amounts of money.
The
conclusion is this. If you stop, and I think this was the kind of deep sentiment, a kind of like an intuitive sentiment of the Brexit vote, banning all immigration or wanting to stop immigration coming into this country. If you stop people coming into this country, and I don't know whether you can actually practically do it, you would immediately have a fairer society. The economy would tank. You would have banks leaving in droves.
You'd have 30% of the NHS just collapsing overnight.
But then you would have English people taking those jobs.
No, you wouldn't, because they're not trained. This is like you're talking
absolute pants.
Something
has just got into your brain and it's using your mouth.
That's the bit where Hayden looks really smart. I'm sure you all really enjoyed that.
I think there was a sort of an intuitive thing that
like
people were
trying
to
nurses.
Do. No, like dropping the population in this country would make it fairer. And as much as it would be awful for all of us for a long period of time, it would fair up society. There would be The capital vested in the top 0.1 or 1% would be necessarily sort of dispersed back to the people at the bottom.
But why would
it?
Because the problem with this country is, and it's always been the way,
because like
is that a very small amount of people.
Fewer people, higher wages. Okay?
Yes, yeah, but that's you're making
people,
a huge
lower,
assumption.
Lower rents.
Huge assumptions here. Because
no,
why
not.
Would
that's,
but
that's,
why
that's
would
an
capital,
economic fact. Fewer people, higher wages. That's a fact.
It's not
that
a fact.
Always happens. No, it is. That's how economies work.
Anyway, so moving on, right, from this very sort of like particular point, I'd like to ask Caroline some questions. Why, I mean, particularly with, you know, because we started this conversation by talking about the freedom of movement.
Yeah.
And when I think about the build up to the Brexit vote, I can't help but thinking of the Breaking Point poster where, you know, Nigel Farage was really trying to, you know, whip up that sense of fear. But behind Nigel Farage was Aaron Banks, who bankrolled an awful lot of the Leave campaign. What do you think someone who is prepared to bankroll that kind of campaign wants from that kind of vote? Like, what is your take on the agenda that a lot of these people who are funding the Leave campaign, what do they want this country to be? What were they hoping their vote would achieve?
I think they want this country to be even more deregulated than it already is. I think they want it to be a tax haven floating off the side of Europe. I think they want it to be the cheapest place to do business with the least regulation and the most profit. I mean, I think that's the bottom line. And I think that's a pretty dismal and frightening prospect, really. So, that's why, again, I would come back and disagree with the Ken Loach position, because I think that the reality of not being in part of the EU is going to be this other vision here, which is pretty scary.
Well, a question for both of you. What would you prefer? A
bubonic plague?
A bubonic plague. If you had to choose.
Okay.
What would you prefer? The United Kingdom under a Labour government post-Brexit, where we're out of the common market and we're sort of floating on the free trade global spectrum, or the same situation under a Tory government, which would cut everything, the countries that do well on the global market are countries like India and China, which are prepared to pay their workers absolutely nothing and cut red tape all over the place, so buildings are collapsing like in Bangladesh, and garments are produced for next to nothing, which you can sell all around the world. Would you prefer a post-Brexit world under the Tories, where there's lots of business coming in but everyone's treated like crap, or a post-Brexit world under Labour, where there's no business coming in and there's no money but everyone's treated really well?
I think that might be a false choice.
Okay.
I think there might be a third way, dare I say.
What's
I think
what's the green way?
Oh my God. Caroline Lucas and Tony
third
Blair.
Way. I know.
Third way.
You heard it first here. No, I think, first of all, that it is possible that that people might change their minds about Brexit, first of all. I mean, one of our policies is absolutely to give people the right to see the small print of whatever the deal looks like when it comes back from Brussels. Theresa May, under great duress, finally agreed that it should be MPs who have a vote on that final deal. I think it should go back to the British people. And I think that in another 18 months' time, when we've seen even more of the lies unravel, you know, the famous bus and its money for the NHS unraveled almost instantly, but other stuff is happening all the time. And one of the areas I'm concerned about is environmental legislation. And I don't think anybody voted on the 23rd of June last year to scrap really important environmental protections for clean water, clean beaches, clean, you know, safe chemicals and so forth. And yet the massive job of recreating all of that environmental legislation with all of the institutions that will need to be set up here, with all of the enforcement mechanisms that would need to be set up because you'd no longer have recourse to the European Commission, to the European Court of Justice and so forth. It is mammoth. It is huge. And so I just think there is a possibility that when people just see the size of what's being proposed and you know, we're already seeing the economic disbenefits in terms of rising inflation and lowering investment and so forth, then it might just be that people look again and that, you know, people will scream, but that's undemocratic, it's against the will of the people. But I genuinely think that the leaders of the Leave campaign very deliberately never set out what Leave would look like. They didn't want to have a common vision because then they wouldn't be able to tell different stories in different places depending on what people wanted to hear. Many people voted with very legitimate grievance about not being able to get onto a housing waiting list or not being able to see a doctor in time and so forth. And a lot of that was manipulated to be, well, that's because of the EU or that's because of migration. Instead of saying that's because government after government has not invested in the local services in your area. So let us try to address the real causes of grievance, I think.
I totally agree. I mean, I was heartened, actually, to see someone, a politician, actually just come out recently, Vince Capel just said, well, I just don't think it's going
to
happen. It's just not going
to
happen.
It does start to, it's starting to feel like that.
But James O'Brien, who, you know, is a good sort of friend of the pod, said recently, and I thought it was really true, it's a really nice idea that the British people are of a character to realise that this is a total sort of shit in the hand and still not say, oh, no, well, we decided that's what we're doing, so we're going to do it anyway. We're going to do it. Oh, no, that was the plan, because that is very sort of British mentality. But I think that actually what's very interesting is watching the metaphors around it change. I watched someone the other day, I can't remember who was an MP, say, you know, the thing is, when you buy a house, you don't sign until it's been surveyed, until you've seen all the contracts through.
Wasn't that Tony Blair's metaphor?
Well, no, I think that
I thought it was very apt for Tony
Blair. Well, that was the selling of the third house,
eight
wasn't
houses.
It? Yeah. But I think the thing that is interesting is just the infeasibility of the situation, where I think people are starting to recognise that 27 countries probably have more power than one. And actually, no matter what the great metaphors about our wonderful empire under which the sun never sets are starting to become a bit tired. But also, you know, what I think the most interesting thing about the election was, and we come back to this again and again, is that more and more younger people are realizing that the narrative of a country that they thought was relatively set, whether it be a country that was free from homophobia, from bigotry, from racism, that believed in environmental protections, that was inclusive, was vanishing when the Brexit vote happened and have started coming out in their droves. Now, as Hayden's saying, if it is to be that there is a Labour government, which is starting to look increasingly likely, will they pursue Brexit as vigorously? I mean, what do you think?
I don't know. It's just such a divided party, isn't it? But that can only be a good thing. I think that Corbyn feels like he has to have this strong position on Brexit because he sees himself as a sort of man of the people. And it was the people that voted for Brexit, not the metropolitan liberal elite. And he doesn't want to be part of that set. But a large part of his voter base comes from that set. And I don't think I think he is quite a pragmatic person. I think you saw that during the last election. I think he, I don't know. I think he'd,
I think there's certainly a potential. The potential is definitely there for a softer landing than there certainly is under Theresa May.
I think the thing that is incredible is that the idea that this could have been negotiated in 18 months, for anyone who knows anything about it, it's utterly fanciful.
Theresa May's face at the G20. You see, she looks haggard. Yeah, she's so tired, and Merkel's sort of romping around the place looking, you know.
Well, I think what they thought they could get is an American free trade agreement that would suddenly be like, see, we've got something. But as I've said before in the podcast, for me, that looks like, you know, privatization of the NHS. I think that what I can foresee happening is this being kicked along past 2020, past 2025. There are such huge, huge things to be negotiated. Mm. We'll probably, in that classic British way, spend tens of millions of pounds, set up a Ministry of Brexit, 10, 15 years later, go, so you don't want to do it?
Yeah.
Oh, all right, don't worry about
and
it.
Stick with what we know. Money will be
utterly, utterly ridiculous.
Do you know about this? Recently seconded 700 civil servants from other departments to the Brexit department.
Yeah.
The money that is being spent on this.
And also just the distraction from other things might be quite important.
Yes, exactly.
Right, so it's, you know, that was a very hearty main.
That was,
with a side portion of bubonic plague, which I've got to be honest, I did not see that coming. I did not see the bleak references there that they be. Sorry, listeners, for our little tiff there. That is basically what it's like whenever we're not actually recording anything.
Yeah.
Which is him going, no, that's right. And I'm going, no, it's not. Yes, it is. Anyway, let's move on swiftly. So
dessert.
Have we got a nice sweet dessert, or is it a, what sort of dessert have we got?
Well, I think we've got a hopeful dessert, because we need a bit of hope, don't we? And something that I derived hope from last week was the fact that kind of unseen by most people, and the national media just didn't really seem to notice it either, 122 countries agreed a treaty at the UN which would ban nuclear weapons, ban the manufacture of them, the sale of them, the retention of them. Anything to do with nuclear weapons would be banned. And 122 countries came together and sat in New York for some months, as they'd sat in a couple of other countries beforehand, and painstakingly negotiated this thing. Now, you will say, I'm sure, well, if the nuclear states aren't round the table, that's not worth very much, is it?
Were the 8 members of the Security Council there?
Let me just explain that. The reason that I still feel a modicum of hope is that every time we've had a treaty to ban things like chemical weapons or cluster munitions, biological weapons, then it has been the countries that don't have them that get together first. They haven't waited for everybody else. They've got together. And then the very being of that, the fact that that thing exists, that treaty ban exists, begins to change people's attitude to those weapons. And so they become much less legitimate. They become stigmatized. And it becomes easier to begin to have that debate about getting rid of them. Because, you know, we talk about sheltering under the nuclear umbrella without batting an eyelid, as if that's a perfectly legitimate thing to be doing. Whereas we don't talk about sheltering under chemical weapons or biological weapons. They are rightly perceived to be beyond the pale. There's no circumstance in which the use of those weapons is legitimate. And yet, nuclear weapons are so much more damaging even than chemical or biological weapons, and yet somehow they are sanitised. And I think any process that can help to desanitise them and let people know and remind them just exactly how damaging these weapons are is a good thing.
Do you ever worry that if we did get rid of nuclear weapons and then one state happened to like create one, we'd all be screwed?
What do you mean create one? Shoot one.
So if we got rid of all of them, and then some rogue state somewhere said, by the way, we've just made one and it's on a bomb, we'd all be up shit creek, wouldn't we?
Well, we'd all be dead.
Well, no, they'd just threaten us. It'd be like blackmail. They'd say, like, do whatever we say or we're going to drop this on you.
Well, I feel like
and we'd all have to do whatever they say.
You know what, genuinely, I feel like that's actually kind of what's happening now, is I think that the North Korean posturing and the firing off in the last couple of weeks of an intercontinental ballistic missile has changed the narrative somewhat, along with the sort of fear of Russia, which seems to have increased exponentially in the last couple of years. Do you think that the public now, sort of in that quite British way, well, if we're going to get punched, we've got to punch back? Do you think that's part of it, why there is a resistance to it?
I think so, and because you so very rarely hear a sort of a reasonable debate about the issue. Because the answer to Hayden's point really is that if that's the case, then why would it not be legitimate for every single country in the world to acquire nuclear weapons? Mm. And once you start imagining what that would look like, then the chances of those weapons falling into the hands of, you know, rogue people or whatever, or terrorists or something, becomes even higher than, frankly, it already is. So it seems to me that having a program whereby you're getting rid of those weapons and you have it monitored for sure, you're not just taking people's words for it. You have institutions like the IAEA, the international institution that's monitoring all of that. It gives us a better chance of keeping safe than a world where, you know, we are trying to lecture Iran or even North Korea come to that to say, well, we're grown up enough to have nuclear weapons, but you're not. Yeah. I mean, I don't want them to have nuclear weapons, but it seems to me that a better way of trying to persuade them that they don't need nuclear weapons is beginning a process ourselves. And this treaty is such that you don't have to have got rid of all your weapons before you sign up. As long as you've got a schedule, a plan, a commitment to begin to disarm, then you can sign up and be part of an ongoing multilateral process.
Is there a way, do you think, you could like put the genie back in the box? Like, could you, if everyone were to get rid of them, could we just like burn all information about how to create them?
No, I don't think you could do that. But I think you would need strict monitoring. I mean, I'm not kind of being completely rose-tinted glasses about this. I mean, I realise that there will be people who will still try to acquire them and so forth. So you would need very, very rigorous monitoring. But, you know, sitting here, we are about to spend up to £200 billion on replacing Trident nuclear weapons. Now, you only need to think a couple of moments about what you could be using that money for at a time when you've got nurses using food banks, when you've got our schools screaming for more resources just to buy basic, you know, basic products for those schools, the pens and papers and so forth. I mean, we have such a bizarre set of priorities. And also, if you look at the government's own strategic defence review, actually, they don't put nuclear war near the top of their list of likely things that will happen. It's more like cyber warfare, terrorism and so forth, for which nuclear weapons are uniquely ill suited.
Yeah. Let's be honest. Let's pull back the veil a little bit here. This is the sort of conversation that would be happening on Radio 4 or Newsnight. Right now, what I think is great about podcasts is you can sort of go a little deeper. Now, we all know, three of us here who have all been to arms fairs, that one of Britain's biggest exports is arms, that there are huge multinational corporations, the Lockheed Martins of this world, for instance, who are deeply embedded with lobbying the British government. Even Rolls-Royce, I believe, who has something to do with the manufacture of engine parts for various components of it, and the jobs that are attached to it. In Scotland, there is a base that literally is just creating, you know, whether it was our latest aircraft carrier, which made its maiden voyage very recently, or other huge weapons that kill people. But there is a concerted effort to undermine that narrative in terms of we try not to see it. So, for instance, in the last week, as we're recording this, arms sales to Saudi Arabia were seen as legally legitimate, irrespective of the fact they cut off people's heads and don't let women drive without, you know, someone else in the car with them, which
bomb
is
Yemeni hospitals.
Yeah, exactly. So what are the real issues here? Let's get, you know, for an informed audience, which I think we have, is it the lobbying?
You hit on it. It's industry. One of the things that Lockheed, and it's interesting, if you go to the tube station just down there in Westminster, there's a huge advert for Lockheed Martin on
there
the
wall. There is, isn't there?
And you're like, well, why would you put a huge advert? When do you ever see an advert for Lockheed Martin?
On the tube.
Anywhere else in London.
Yeah.
And what, is an MP just walking down the escalators being like, oh yeah, I might buy one of those missiles. But obviously not. What they're doing is they're saying, and Lockheed Martin is so smart with this. Interestingly, they run and own our Trident nuclear submarine deterrent. And in fact, we can't even let them off without a guy in a Lockheed Martin office somewhere basically pushing a button on our behalf. So Lockheed Martin control our nuclear deterrent. It's insane. But anyway, when they make these things, they kind of feed jobs off to factories all around the world. So they get support from MPs and tiny little constituencies all around the world. And it kind of builds this...
What's your perspective on this aspect of it?
Well, it's interesting, actually, because during the leader debates in the last general election, I challenged Amber Rudd about arms sales to Saudi Arabia. And her reply was exactly that there's a lot of business wrapped up in this. That's exactly what she said. I mean, I would have thought that you wouldn't, you know, you might have had some kind of reticence about admitting that, but she was absolutely, it's about business, you know. So the idea that we're kind of committing ourselves to global annihilation because that's the best way to create jobs seems to me to be quite bizarre. And if you work out how much each job costs because of the huge amount of money that we're investing in nuclear weapons, then with a fraction of that money, you could be gainfully employing people in jobs that are probably, you know, equally as technical and as rewarding, but also doesn't have the slight downside of global annihilation.
So you could do with that.
So I'm to be a bit serious about this. I recognise that lots of the transitions we talk about, you know, whether that's from nuclear to non-nuclear or fossil fuels to renewables or whatever, I really do recognise that for people right now in those jobs, that is deeply threatening. And I would feel the same if my job was on the line.
Yeah.
So I think that the language that others have used and the ideas that others have had around having, you know, processes, commissions and so forth that are absolutely demonstrating very practically how you could use the skills of those people, but to translate it to something else.
Creating renewables, for instance.
Yeah, I mean, huge, do you remember that Lucas Aerospace thing going back into the several decades ago? It was producing weapons and the workers got together and came up with a whole blueprint of how they could be producing something far more socially useful. And that goes back decades they did that. But it was really
practical.
Did they
do it?
No.
Right.
but it was still a good idea. So we need to do that bit of the job, but it's not beyond the wit of people to do that. It
seems
really
so obvious.
But it's also sort of, I think, I mean, we probably have very different perspectives, but I actually don't think it's a surprise at all. You know, we come from a country that's been supplying weapons to, you know, all around the world, really, since before the Opium Wars. You know, like there is a Britain that we know, that the public venerates, the Daily Mail, Daily Express vision of Britain, and there's a kind of revisionist version of Britain. And I think, actually, in 50 years' time, as I've, you know, said to you before, you know, you're going to be a person of huge historical significance, because the nature of, you know, being the first Green MP in Parliament with a, you know, culture where these ideas are permeating through the internet in a way that is unstoppable. Young people are much more switched on to these political issues than they've ever been. And, you know, they're not that unrealistic. France has just said by 2024 they're going to ban all diesel cars,
Sweden,
right?
Sweden carbon neutral.
Yeah.
Saying,
And I think that what we, you know, I hope in a way this podcast and various things we're trying to do is bring consciousness to these issues. So just in this very little point about the nuclear thing and particularly about the arms trade, where would you recommend that people find out a bit more information if they're interested in finding out, you know, behind the curtain what's kind of going on?
Well, I'd love to give a plug to the Campaign Against the Arms Trade, CAT. They have done some fantastic work, and in fact they are taking, in fact they did take the UK to court over the arms sales to Saudi Arabia. They did that last week. They lost, but they're going to appeal it. So, you know, there are some really fantastic people there who go undercover to arms fairs, and you know, I went along with them once, and it was, you know, really interesting and important, because they know what they're looking for. I mean, they're really, really shit hot on this stuff. So CAT is fantastic. Look at their website, get involved with them. Obviously with CND, Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, again, their website, fantastic stuff there. And get people back involved again. When I was young, CND, loads of young people were part of it. And with lots of respect for CND,
somehow,
now that is, average age is an awful lot older. We need to get young people back involved in that whole thing.
Caroline, when are you ready for us to plan a coup d'etat and plant you at the top of...
I was going to ask you that. Yeah.
So you can be a sort of benevolent dictator.
August?
And, sounds good. Are you free August?
I think basically when we can just about get more than I think we need a couple more million followers.
Right.
And then we can start calling for the sort of social revolt that like Brand was calling about, but maybe just be a little bit more informed about it. And then hopefully at that point we can sort of place you what at the top of... I mean, the big thing is, would you curtsy to the Queen? I mean, that's the only thing the Daily Mail want to know.
You're right. Yeah.
Yeah. No, exactly. No. Yes. There you go. Exclusive. Caroline Lucas refuses. Well, that's it, you're done now. It just leaves for us to say, Caroline Lucas, thank you so much for joining us. Is there anything you want to just tell us? Is there anything that's coming up in the next year that people should particularly be looking out for? Or
I was just thinking about the after dinner mints, really. But
what
they should be looking out for the next year.
We want to be looking for God.
the trouble is there's just so much, isn't there? But please, can we get climate back on the agenda?
Definitely.
Please.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yes, thank you, Caroline, and hope to have you for a roast again soon.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you.